From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, December 5th, 2017. And on this day, details on the recommendations on the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monuments and on the complaint against Oxford County Sheriff Wayne Gallant. That and more ahead in just a moment. One day after President Donald Trump signed a proclamation to dramatically reduce the size of two national monuments in Utah, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke released his final recommendations for other monuments around the country. That includes Katahdin Woods and Waters here in Maine. Susan Sharon has more.
Secretary Zinke is proposing to downsize more than half a dozen other monuments, but he's recommending that Katahdin Woods and Waters' 87,500 acres be kept intact. In his report, he highlights the fact that although commercial timbering is not typically allowed in the national park system, there is limited authority to, quote, conserve certain objects. He then suggests changing the monument's proclamation. Zinke would have it promote a healthy forest through active timber management. Kathy Johnson of the Natural Resources Council of Maine calls those two ideas internally inconsistent.
Because on the one hand, it says that they need to follow the provisions of the Antiquities Act, which would not allow commercial timber harvesting. And then on the other hand, they say that they want to prioritize a healthy forest through active timber management. So it's very unclear what they really intend to do.
In his recommendation, Zinke goes on to say that a management plan should be developed to prioritize public access, infrastructure upgrades, traditional and cultural use, and hunting and fishing rights. But there is no further explanation included. Final action will be left up to the president. And Johnson says if the proclamation is amended to allow commercial timber harvesting, her organization will likely take legal action. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Oxford County commissioners today voted unanimously to file a formal complaint to remove Sheriff Wayne Gallant from office for inappropriate sexual conduct. As Patty White reports, the matter is now in the hands of Governor Paul LePage.
After spending most of the day in executive session, the three commissioners convened an open session by mid-afternoon, where Commissioner David Doogie promptly made a motion
to issue a complaint to the governor with respect to the sheriff in the form reviewed by the commissioners in executive session.
After Commissioner Stephen Merrill seconded the motion, Chair Timothy Turner asked for discussion.
Not seeing any, I'll call for a vote.
And with that, the three voted unanimously to file a complaint with Governor LePage to remove Gallant from office. The move comes 2 weeks after sexual allegations against Gallant came to light publicly. But the commissioner's attorney, Brian Dench, says the investigation began 3 weeks ago.
My advice to the commissioners when these concerns first surfaced was to have it investigated independently so there could be no question that the commissioners had information, facts that were reliable before they took any action.
The findings of that investigation, according to the complaint, are that Gallant sent lewd photos of himself to a female in another law enforcement agency while he was in uniform in county offices. He also sent indecent photos of himself and text messages that solicited sex acts and nude photos to subordinate employees, a subordinate officer, and the officer's female companion. Those actions, according to the commissioner's complaint, have undermined Gallant's ability to lead a law enforcement agency and command the confidence and respect of the department and the public. The commissioners formally asked Governor LePage to remove Gallant from office and appoint another sheriff for the remainder of the term. Attorney Dench says that's as far as the commissioner's authority extends.
So the process is now in the hands of the governor.
Governor LePage did not respond to the complaint immediately, but on Monday, LePage said that if he received a complaint regarding Gallant, he would hold a hearing to determine whether to remove the sheriff. Gallant and his attorney did not respond to a request for comment by airtime. Gallant has previously admitted to sending a lewd photo to another woman, but he's denied allegations that he solicited sex from employees. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Companies that install small solar generation projects in Maine have been given a little bit more time before the State Public Utilities Commission reduces the incentives that help people make up some of the cost of installation. It's the latest chapter in the ongoing controversy over the way those small-scale generators are compensated for excess electricity they provide. Fred Bever has more.
For decades, Maine has offered solar projects credits for electricity they generate beyond what is used on site. Early this year, the State Public Utilities Commission created a new rule that will reduce the value of those credits over time. Existing arrays would be grandfathered, but the ramp down for new systems was set to begin on New Year's Day. But that's now delayed until April 30th, as the commission has decided to give installers and utilities more time to iron out technical protocols, new fee structures, and new billing systems.
Good day for the solar folks. Be able to sleep tomorrow morning.
The delay is a relief for installers like Vaughn Woodruff of InSource Renewables, who says his company and others in Maine have seen a rush of customers trying to get in under the wire to lock in the highest possible incentives.
There are customers right now that have systems, they're installed and ready to go, and due to delays with the utilities around the storm, the utility's not ready for them to be hooked up.
Data provided by Central Maine Power show that requests for new solar hookups this year are running 35% higher than last, driven by a big surge in the last quarter that's brought the total to more than 800. In a written statement, a CMP spokeswoman said the company appreciates the PUC ruling and the chance to work through the, quote, complexities of the new system. Some solar power advocates, meanwhile, say those complexities are emblematic of a poorly conceived rule.
Yeah, I think the closer you get to an impending train wreck, the more likely it is that you'll step on the brakes.
Brunswick Representative Seth Berry, a Democrat, co-chairs the legislature's Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Technology. He's been a leading defender of solar power incentives and a critic of what he sees as attempts by utilities to squelch any innovations that might cut into their profits. And while Governor Paul LePage has vetoed recent efforts to encourage solar development, Berry says delay of the PUC's new rule will give the legislature another shot.
Do we want to do something more like what other states have done and not become anti-solar, anti-customer pariah?
And even before the legislature acts, the state's Supreme Judicial Court is likely to weigh in. An unusual coalition of solar advocates and large energy users, such as paper mills, is challenging the PUC's solar rule, saying it puts illegal burdens on the production of energy that's used only on site. Sean Mahoney is executive vice president of the Conservation Law Foundation.
I think the takeaway is that the PUC is realizing that this kind of Frankenstein that they've created is a lot more difficult to implement than they would have thought and raises a host of kind of policy and fairness issues, never mind technical issues. But I don't think that the decision today has changed the PUC's opinion with respect to the merits of the underlying rule. And that's a matter that is going to have to be resolved by the law court.
And as the policy debate continues, InSource Renewables' Vaughn Woodruff says he and other developers just want to get off what's now known as the solar coaster and onto firmer ground.
So that we can invest money in Maine's economy, that customers, as they're looking at investing in the energy infrastructure of the future, have some predictability to do so, and that we're looking at a long-term solution that solves a lot of questions that folks from both sides have brought up.
The Supreme Judicial Court hears oral arguments on Maine's residential solar power rules next Wednesday. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And finally today, as Congress moves through the process of potentially passing a major tax reform passage, we're still just starting to get a sense of what's in there and what it might mean. Advocates for affordable housing in Maine are saying the package could be disastrous. Diane Yentel is president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She's in Portland today at a meeting of about 75 affordable housing organizations and advocates at the University of Southern Maine. Diane, the Maine Affordable Housing Coalition saying the House version of this bill would reduce the number of affordable homes created or preserved in Maine by nearly half at a time when housing's less and less affordable for lower and middle income Americans. In your estimation, would this bill make the housing crisis worse and how?
it would make the housing crisis worse immediately by reducing or restricting some key tools that are used for affordable housing development and preservation. Specifically, the low-income housing tax credit program, which is the largest production program for affordable homes in the country. That's an impact in Maine that would have the biggest overall impact of reduction of affordable homes. It would reduce by almost 40% the affordable homes that could be built over the next 10 years. The other way that the tax bills could really impact the affordable housing crisis is by increasing the deficits so significantly. The Joint Center on Taxation, which is a nonpartisan committee that looks at impacts of tax bills, says that we would have an increased debt of over $1 trillion over 10 years. What that will mean over time will be a push to reduce federal spending, including key affordable housing and community development programs.
Are there other specific concerns about the House and Senate bills?
The third is, you know, and it's really the center of these tax bills, is the significantly reduced corporate tax rate. So by reducing corporate tax rates from 35% potentially down to 20%, that reduces the value of the low-income housing tax credit. And that means less equity available to build and preserve affordable homes. So that change alone, just lowering the corporate tax rate and its impact on the low-income housing tax credit program, could mean nationally 200,000 less affordable homes built or preserved over 10 years.
The argument's been made for this tax bill that the policies therein, by encouraging investment, would ultimately reduce demand for these sorts of services because people would be getting more money in their pockets because there would be more jobs available. How do you respond to those sorts of arguments?
Well, I think what we've seen from economists' studies, what we've seen from the state of Kansas, who tried something similar with its tax package, is that when corporations have their tax rates lowered to such a degree, it does not translate into better jobs, necessarily more jobs, higher wages. What it translates into is bigger bonuses for people who work at the corporations and increased dividends for the investors.
I assume your organization and others have been lobbying in the Senate and House about these bills. What reaction are you getting, or what response are you getting from members of Congress on your concerns?
Well, it's interesting being here in Maine right now, where Senator Collins has such leverage in these debates and has always been such a champion for affordable housing and community development programs and for all programs that impact low-income people. We were really disappointed to see her vote in favor of this Senate bill that can have such a negative impact on affordable homes. So we're really hoping that moving forward, she reconsiders and recognizes the negative impact that this will have on her low-income constituents who are in desperate need of affordable homes.
What are you suggesting that organizations and that members of Congress do in the next few weeks as this goes forward?
Well, the first thing that we have to do is do everything we can to defeat these harmful, regressive tax policies. And this is a place where Senator Collins, again, she has been a champion in the past on those very type of issues. We need her to vote no on this package and to bring other Republicans with her so that we can start over on a bipartisan tax bill that has a process that allows for experts to analyze the impacts of the tax reforms and for the public to have some really key input. And then also, in the meantime, if this tax package does move forward, we need to ensure that we are not harming critical affordable housing and community development programs, that we are not eliminating private activity bonds or doing other things to reduce the value of the low-income housing tax credit at a time when these kind of resources are critically needed.
That's Diane Yentel, President and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. And you can find more of our conversation at mainepublic.org. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, December 5th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.